Philosophy 10, May 19th, 1954.
Today and Friday and next week, Wednesday and Friday. And I said I wanted to give you the personal sketches of some of the men who have built up the two sides of academic and university life and are now, so we must hope, able to free us from the curse of the academic cycle by building up another one. That of society, that of the social science, that of this knowledge of how man behaves towards men. He said that the academic cycle says how all men together view the world of things. And we know it pretty well. We can even translate mass into energy or energy into mass. And that was the secret of the gold makers, which they were after and we have solved it. Before now going into the personal situation of the people who in this great enterprise, gentlemen, are our ancestors and are your ancestors, not only, but those who, for whom you must pray in as far as they have not existed yet and have not come to secure your future. Let me first point out the excess of the scholastic cycle and the excess of the academic cycle, which at this moment makes their super being superseded by a third one indispensable. What is wrong with your view that you want to be objective and scientific? Well, gentlemen, when it comes to yourself, that's the end of objectivity. You want to be treated personally with regards, and you want to be forgiven when you flunk a course or when you have a girl in your room and are to be severed from college. Then you expect that the dean works a miracle and lets you stay. Always when you want to be an exception from a rule, do you need a social science which can understand that you are an exception from a rule? Every man is, you know. We all are. Otherwise we couldn't. You know, it's in Shakespeare, treat everybody according to his merit and nobody is safe. Now, not one of us can be treated according to our merits. Otherwise, we would have long ceased to exist. We have to be executed. If you come to think of it, universalism, according to which everybody, in which creed everybody goes to heaven, is really a very strange doctrine, can only be explained by the natural feeling of everybody that if all people are treated equally, they would all go to hell. In the life or the course of 70 years, there's so much weakness in every one of us, and so much craziness of heart, and so much cowardice, and so much forgetfulness, gentlemen, has already been in your life, that certainly universalism of universal brimstone and hellfire is much more probable than the opposite doctrine, which came in, as you know, at the time when 100 years ago people thought that nothing could happen to them anymore, that they were on the verge of eternal progress. In this verge of eternal progress, we have invented the cobalt bomb or the atom bomb, I don't know which to name. But we have also discovered in the academic cycle, think of Russia, that it is possible to treat everybody as a thing, objectively. The word objectively to you has something harmless. It is much better than you write down, objectively means to treat somebody as a thing. That's what it means. Now, you want everybody to be treated, you want to treat everybody objectively, I'm sure. But gentlemen, not one of you wants to be treated objectively, really. Not one of you. It is impossible to want this. If you treat your neighbor objectively, he'll go to war against you. That is, the application of the thing principle to humanity, gentlemen, leads to eternal war. leads to suicide. The treatment of oneself as a thing is the principle that is at the base of every act of suicide, because it means that I can do with myself as I please. This you can only do if you are your own thing. If man is one his own thing, which is really a complete schizophrenic situation, you see, then by his mind he can decide that he can take his body. And that is by and large the American situation, that every businessman feels that he has the right to blow out his brain. And you just are 20 years off the corner, but at 45 most of you will have the same temptation. You're just now playboys who think, oh, that will never happen because it's also nice. Gentlemen, nice is no reason to stay in life, and ugly is no reason to go out of it. Suffering is no reason to take your life, and joy is no reason to stay in life. If you think so, gentlemen, you're quite mistaken. If you think because you are relatively happy now that you are safe against suicide, that's a mistake. You just haven't lived yet. In other countries, all over the world, gentlemen, suicide has been sweated out for the last 150 years, since Goethe, the German poet, in 1772 wrote a book called Werther, W-E-R-T-H-E-R, in which the problem of suicide is squarely placed before a young man who is disappointed in love and life. And ever since, the people in Europe have, you know, from the Romantics, in English poetry, from Keats and Shelley. Shelley did commit suicide, as you know. There are others. They have sweated it out. That is, if a man came from a university and was 25 years of age, you could be sure that in one dark night he has played with the idea of taking his life. He had a pistol or a dagger on his night table and he tried if he could do it. And therefore the people in mature age have not committed suicide, because they were vaccinated. You are, as you boast, unfortunately 12 years old. That is, and nothing is serious. And you will run up at 30 or 40 or 50 against some steep corner, and then you will not be prepared. The problem of suicide, gentlemen, is the application of the object principle to oneself. It's a typical academic thing. The old Roman Empire, gentlemen, saw the nobility of Rome commit suicide by the thousands. Seneca did it, and all his ilk. In the first 100 years of our era, the whole nobility of Rome committed suicide, because they were Stoics, they were academics, they were philosophers. And philosophy leads to the right of suicide, because philosophy claims to have the right to judge the world. And once you put yourself into the world, as a part of the world, there's absolutely no reason why there should be a difference between the poor uranium and yourself. If you can blow up uranium, you can also blow up yourself. If everything is just everything, gentlemen, and everybody is just everybody, bodies are mortal. Bodies are transient. There's absolutely no reason why your body should be different from uranium. And so we blow it up both. One, your own body you blow up by private means, and the universe we blow up by communal means. And so public law and private law in wonderful harmony. The Constitution of the United States can then be realized. You see, and it says that in the decent respect for the opinion of mankind commands to say that everybody can take his life and the community can take the universe. The life of the universe. That's by and large the doctrine that is held today. Therefore, gentlemen, since this is an untenable state of affairs, that you can blow up the universe just because you have the billions of dollars to waste on it in these various places, and because you claim the right that when your brother wants to commit suicide, he may do so, I at least want to emigrate from this country, in the sense that I do not belong to a community in which these two rights are claimed. I have neither the right to blow up the created matter, nor have I the right to blow up myself. I look therefore for a different treatment of human beings and of matter. Obviously, it isn't true that peace can be made with things, gentlemen. Against things we wage war. It is not, gentlemen, in contradiction to the 400 years of humanism, of Platonism, of Aristotelianism, of liberal education. But it is the logic that it ended in two world wars. The period from 1500 to 1900 had absolutely no reason to stop war, because it was objective. Now, the best thing you can do with a human mind is to manipulate things. And the safest way of manipulating is to blow them, or to eat them, or to manufacture them, or to do what you please with them. To have soil erosion, to cut down all the forests, to have river water pollution. You know that all is in order if the rivers are owned by you. But if you are owned by the rivers, as in Persia, where the sign of a free man was that he couldn't pollute a river because he worshipped it, then obviously the river is not a thing. And therefore it cannot be polluted. It cannot. And it may not. And it is not in such a country. As you know, the Persians had only two terrible things, and therefore they were before the philosophy ever polluted the world. They said, don't pollute the water, and don't pollute your mind by lying. Now, in this country, as you know, the big lie is officially now enthroned in the Senate of America, and the pollution of rivers is not yet abolished. And on this basis, gentlemen, you see what philosophy can do to you. It makes you so powerful that you can lie, as we do every day in propaganda, in advertising, and expect you. We call it psychology. Psychology is a way of making people do things which they do not want to do. I call this cheating. It's called a science in this country. When Chesterton, the Englishman, came to this country, he said, Spanish. We call lying what they in America call psychology, because psychology say makes people do things which they otherwise wouldn't do. Now in England we have still the old fashion of calling this cheating. It's called psychology in this country.
I don't understand what you mean when you said that the Europeans have sweated out the idea of suicide. You mean that because of the fact that they've thought of suicide before they're 25 and overcome it, they're mature at the age of 25 and we're not until 40?
Well, it's like a vaccination. You get the fever in a small disease to a small portion, but not totally. Therefore, when the fever really grips you, you are immune. You have immune.
Is it possible for you to take hold of 25 and turn you right there?
Well, our teachers in school used to say adolescents have to be risked in order to make men. Three men in my class committed suicide in the first 3 years after we graduated. So it's absolutely costly and expensive, you know. But the freedom was certainly also, you see, used, abused. Don't think that there weren't many students who committed suicide. But the rest, having shared this experience with those who went the full way, you see, certainly were, you see, knew what it was all about. Knew that where the limits of human action on human objectivity were. They knew that man does not have himself. Gentlemen, that's the problem. We are talking at this moment of the limitations of academic science. Academic science tries to transform everything into a thing. I've tried to talk to you since the last meeting, in telling you that the scientist remained a miracle. That any scientist is a miracle because he says something for the first time and therefore he cannot be deduced by logic, you remember? However, if you go to the whole way and treat, as in The Brave New World or in Surface Man, that's a very good book by a Danish writer, Arve Madelung, or when you go to all these links of 1984, you have the application of the principles of modern science to men. What I want you to understand is, gentlemen, that you don't have to look to Russia, and you don't have to look to Aldous Huxley's novel of 1984. You have to look into your own mind to find the excesses of academic thinking. You are the people who have to wake up to the fact that the way you have organized your thinking, and you are run by machine mechanized thinking, you have every reason to hope that you will be freed and delivered from this terrible juggernaut of nonsense. Because you believe that it is desirable that men are treated objectively, and that it is possible. I've tried to show you that before you can treat things scientifically, you must live in a society which knows what peace is. And you must live under an authority which gives you direction. Now, we said the academic world knows all about all things about the universe. But the universe has neither direction nor has it peace. The universe is at war, and the universe moves in silence, in vicious circles. That's why you get to be a philosophy of mystery for Mr. Spengler or Mr. Toynbee, which shows you that everything is cyclical. That's the application of the academic thinking to men, on men. That is all. Why should I be part of a civilization which has its ups and downs? You think I'm just a top or a ball or rubber ball? That's really what people try to tell you and me, that everything we do is just up and down, or jip and jump. Well, how is this word, Mr. Toynbee? And he thinks that's even wisdom. No, the other, the Chinese. Jin and... Yes. I would say that's just nonsense. Certainly, life begins where a person says, this must be prevented. I, as a human being, am not willing to go in for such a natural nonsense. And everybody is overawed by this nonsense by which we have relapsed into pre-Christian times, when men was treated as in China, as a part of the natural universe. There's no science then, because if I have to think what the universe commands in me with up and down and jip and jump and jing and jang and however and response and what is this other? These dualisms, it's there. Ladies and gentlemen, wherever you have dichotomies, you have nature. And you have slavery. You have no freedom. If everything is either or, said gentlemen, I'm not there. Men begins where he says neither. No. You see, if you want to reform the United States of America, you certainly must be neither a Republican nor a Democrat at this moment. If you think you have to be either one, you're lost. Because what this country needs is a decent civil service, which you can only get if you are neither a Democrat nor a Republican. For example, only to show you that the neither nors are the cheapest thing in the world, they always are only applicable to things. This is black or white. This is green or gray. That's really very important to know if I deal with your coat or with your shirt, that you're of course black and white. You're a saint and a sinner. And they're like the things. That is, we all begin on the other side of dichotomies. We can, because we begin with the experience of peace. And gentlemen, the experience of peace is that it's not a question of being either a woman or a man, either old or young. It's the experience that we have to have women and men and young and old people. Well, that's why the church today is so funny, by gathering young married couples and the teenagers and the old people together. Well, that's easy to have peace, but the church is there for the peace between the incompatibles. So the church is just a joke today, because it is naturalistic. It unites the people who are united anyway for naturalistic reasons. There's no minister in your necessary to tell the young couple that they can dance to baby trouble. That is not, that's natural. It's no longer anything divine or inspired in the church if you group them by natural for natural reasons. But that's everywhere in this country. And the higher up you come into the so-called spiritual world in the church, the more objective and the more natural is everything done. They're all rubbish things. For you knew it's no worse nothing before. It's very typical that the church today lives by rummage, where every contribution is worthless. People give to the rummage that which they think is no longer needed by them. And that's how you try to group humanity. On the, you call this rummage sale in humanity, you know how you call it, psychology or sociology? It's the lowest common denominator. That's your rummage sale, a fellow of humanity. And you say that you have to unite people on the lowest common denominator. That's the law of the universe at this moment in this country. Gentlemen, never get with anybody together on the lowest common denominator. Be yourself a separate toilet. It's worth it. That's the lowest common denominator. Who wants to unite on these needs, these common needs of the lowest common denominator? We all have to shift, certainly. There's no reason to form a club for that. But that's the idea of your psychology, gentlemen. That's exactly the I only translated into so many terms. I told you that when leadership proper, didn't I tell you the story of the psychologists in the Air Force? $8 million spent on a transparent toilet seat so that the people could watch who should become general of the Air Force, how he behaved on the toilet. That's done today. Gentlemen, don't think that I'm joking, Ms. Rummage Sale. It's exactly true. $8 million in a country that has not a cent for a decent salary for a teacher, school teacher or minister. But $8 million are spent for this nonsense. And you call this science. At the Yale University, I've seen this instrument of torture myself. And the psychologist was not, he didn't despise himself for doing that, for pitching in there and spying on the, how the people looked from the other side. Well, you have not to despise the Air Force people, but the psychologists and you people who adore this kind of science, instead of laughing and out of court. Now this is then, gentlemen, the naturalistic treatment of men against which today we have to protest. Because otherwise we'll all be killed in the process. Or you will kill yourself, that's the same. The same situation, gentlemen, prevailed 400 years back. At that moment, as you know, the scholastic cycle thought it could also understand things, and not only God. And so they burned the witches, they burned the Artemis, because these people turned to things, and said for things, there is a different principle necessary, the academic principle, and not this university principle, remember. It cannot be decided by discussion between two opposite opinions whether gold can be turned into matter, into energy, you see, can be set free. It's important, we have to try it. And you remember that the university cycle consists in the application of this new principle that except for motion, every fact about things has to be investigated all over the globe. You remember? And I've asked you to read the life of the classic and the founder. It will be an examination question. This pamphlet in on reserve, in which I try to give back the honor is due to Paracelsus, the man who for the first time formulated the new problem of science, that nothing can be deduced by argument about a plant or an animal or a stone or the climate. You have to go there before you don't know. You all are, take this for granted, gentlemen. They have came into the world with the same difficulty as today it is for myself to get a hearing when I say that science is overstepping its mark when it deals with the first and second person. That science can neither develop authority about things, because things have no authority. Yet, obviously, you have to have authority for the application of science, for science, for example. And you have to have unanimous consent in society that there shall be science. Now, gentlemen, the sentence, there shall be science, is not a scientific sentence. It's a dogma, which you all believe. It's a part of the Christian dogma that God created the world, and that therefore we better look into it, how he created it. Will you take this down then? The dogma, let there be science, is not a scientific sentence. Let there be science is an imperative. It's a command. Why do you bother? The superstitious man says, let there no be, not be science. Let there first be Christian science. But let there no be, not be science. You still have today people who are afraid of science and say no. And then there are others who say, science is. You don't have to command it. You don't have to explain how this command came into the world. This is your fault. You think science is. Gentlemen, there has to be a dictum, a dogma, let there be science, so that the rich people in this country give enough money so that we can have research. You take this for granted. Why do they do it then? Because we know that the world is not a devil seed or hellfire, but is God's creation. It's an orderly world. And it deserves to be known, because for that purpose it was created. So that men might rule it and manipulate it and use it. And lead things to their destination. So gentlemen, the sentence, let there be science, stands outside the academic cycle itself, for the simple reason that it must be believed by the people who send their children to college and have not gone to an academic cycle themselves. That is, the sentence, let there be science, is common to uneducated and educated men. If you make it a reservation of the educated men alone, the educated men will always be in the minority, and the people in Wisconsin will chase you and say, we don't need scientists. There was a professor of milk diet and milk treatment in Wisconsin, and he was dismissed because he dared to say that margarine butter was not bad. That was enough to have a professor at the University of Madison, Wisconsin, you see, lose his job. Because the farmers in Wisconsin did not think that the science sentence, let there be science, applied to them. Now you, I think, will not approve of this dismissal of this professor, and at least you will hope to God that there is a neighboring state in which this truth can be taught. So that Madison, Wisconsin has not a monopoly. Because if you think that everywhere the people cannot be told the truth about their hobby and their pet and their idol and their illusion, you see, we are really just saying that it is hopeless, that there will never be science, because the one thing we are interested ourselves in must never be touched. It happens to be butter in Wisconsin. But you have something similar. So gentlemen, we do take this down. The sentence, let there be science, has been under debate for the last 400 years. I think in your sense of natural science, the science of things. Let there be a science of all things, of the universe. And I want to say that by 1500, this sentence had to be preached and introduced because the theologian said, no. We know all about witches. We know all about algebras. We know all about the earth turning around the sun. So therefore, gentlemen, the sentence, let there be science, had to be introduced into the education of mankind at a certain hour. At this moment, in 1954, it has to be limited again to its proper meaning. And it can only mean, let there be a science of natural things. Stop. So gentlemen, you don't know this double-edged sword. The same sentence, let there be science, was a triumph in 1500. Let there be a science of things, of all things. Let us put this down. Every word here is equally important. The theologian said in 1500 or 1486, there are witches. That's the time of year in which at the end of the Middle Ages only, 70 people said, these alchemists, these people who discover new Africa and new world, they are demonic. They are not, you see, admitted to the kingdom and the church and Christianity. That's the year in which the so-called Hammer of the Witches was published. It's very interesting, gentlemen, that the $8 million spent on the toilet at the Yale University at the end of this period show you a similar frivolous attempt to overstep the mark of one of the suicides. When the two Dominican brethren in 1486 said that about the nature of things, they knew everything because they knew the incarnation, believed in the incarnation, and they knew about the secrets of God. They made exactly the same mistake with regard to things which the psychologist today makes with regard to people. It is equally stupid to say that by observing shitting, and I can know whether this man is a leader. Then to say, because I know all about God and his saints, I can know how good he is without looking at God. I want you to understand that the mistake is the same mistake. It is the overstepping of the inherent meaning of your enterprise. The inherent meaning of theology was, who is in authority? What is an authority? Remember, it was the discovery that the authority of God was always greater than the authority of the sinner and of his father confessor. And that the authority of justice was always greater than the authority of former emperor. And that the authority of a plague from heaven, like an epidemic, was always greater than the Arabian or the Latinist. It was always the problem of the higher command, the higher authority. When you, however, apply this to things which are under authority, which have no authority in themselves, you go wrong. And that was a tremendous mistake of the medieval cycle, and with which you are very well acquainted. But gentlemen, on the whole, your mind is 200 years obsolete. You believe in the prejudices of Benjamin Franklin against the Middle Ages. And then you think it's wonderful to discover the lightning rod. And that's why you have it on one of your houses. That is, you believe, as in 1750, that there are only two ways of science. One is the logical way into religion, and the other into the natural science. And then you say, let's try also to social society, must be ruled by similar laws. And that's why you have today these Guggenheim and Ford Foundation and Rockefeller money applied to men as though they were ants and bees, or antelopes. Gentlemen, long ago in the French Revolution, there was a man who rose in disgust against the physicists and mathematicians, just as I feel today against Mr. Einstein and Oppenheimer, etc. These fools who didn't know what they were doing when they divulged the secrets of the universe to the government. And now they are very much surprised. At least they should have known what they were doing, that they were just armament and munition factories, manufacturers, nothing else. Well, this situation you think is new. Don't believe it for a minute. The cycle of the sciences has always had the same border region in which it began to fall of grace. And my attempt today is to show you that the cycle of the natural sciences today, very clearly, is at its wit's end. And that was proclaimed by the founders of the new way of life under Napoleon. In the Napoleonic Wars, a man in France got up and said, and you could repeat it today with the same emphasis, but perhaps not so eloquent as he said, get you down, you mathematicians, you physicists, you chemists. What do I see? You sell out to the highest bidder for the production of new armaments, you sell your soul. You want to prove to the government that you deserve their support for your scientific endeavors, and those who promise them better guns. and better ammunition and better steamships for the Navy. And you succeed. And therefore, you have prostituted your science. Step down from the place in society which the naive people have given you wantonly, and make room for those who will warm those hearts again which you have frozen out. That is said, gentlemen, by a very great man, and for this sentence is he great. And if he said nothing else, he would have been you and my sponsor of your survival, of your freedom. And the man's name is, does anybody know? It is the Count Henri de Saint-Simon. He is the founder of socialism, you know, the founder of the social science. And he is despised today because Marxian have said that he was a fantastic man, but that Marx knew it all. Marx and Comte, the man who was a god in this college for many years, Auguste Comte, are both afterthoughts, so to speak, of Saint-Simon. Saint-Simon was a count of the old Frankish Empire, a descendant of Charlemagne, and one day he said to himself, for 1,000 years my family has enjoyed the privileges of the Carolingian Empire and of the old church. I have a tremendous fortune. I have a tremendous rank. All this I must make down to become worthy of the new cycle of life which we must start. I must cease to be a count. I must cease to be rich. I must cease to be respected. Because I must go down into the dirt from scratch and share the fate of this man who works in the sweat of his brow. Because otherwise I cannot solve the new problem of society. That's a very great thing to do, this gentleman. And Henri de Saint-Simon, will you take him down? He's the first man who was hit, who was oppressed by the necessity of breaking the scientific cycle of the physicists and the mathematicians. He lives from 1760 to 1825. And the fact that you don't know of him, gentlemen, doesn't mean that he is obsolete, but only that you are ignorant. Because, gentlemen, such a sponsor of the future can be unknown for 300 years or 500 years. It doesn't make any difference. Jesus was unknown in 280 to Plotinus when he wrote his philosophy. 280 years, that this man is totally obsolete. Because it wasn't so. 30 years later, the emperor became a Christian. So the Saint-Simonists, gentlemen, are not obsolete. But you are, because you live in a protected, sheltered academic environment in which this is taken seriously. Now, gentlemen, what is great about Saint-Simon is that he was the first existentialist. That is, he said, if I want to begin a new life, I mustn't do it with the mind. I must do it bodily. I must do it with my whole existence. I must go out of the old world. So he went to America and he fought in the war of independence for America. And he proposed the Panama Canal to the Viceroy of Spain, Mexico. So in these two acts, he made himself, as you see, a citizen of the future. His disciples built the Suez Canal. The Suez Canal is not an economic venture. The Suez Canal was the second great idea of Saint-Simon to change the map of the world so that the worlds could get to each other, to make serious use of our knowledge that the world is working. Now, I think that's quite a brave. He encompassed the two greatest canal problems of the world. The Panama Canal, in his youth when he was 23. And when he died, he left a group of disciples who were in Egypt and actually built the Panama Canal. And Lesseps, who has heard of Lesseps? Well, I'm glad. Is the Saint-Simonist. And his spiritual ancestors are the men who inspired him to try both the Suez and the Panama Canal in Saint-Simon. You remember what he said about Copernicus and Tycho Brahe and Galilei, you remember, and Kepler, before the generations? Well, so don't be surprised when Lesseps was the third generation after Saint-Simon. Saint-Simon died in 1825. Lesseps built the Panama Canal in 1892, and in 1869, Aida was composed by Verdi for the opening of the Suez Canal in Egypt. Will you take down these dates? You say that Goethe built the Panama Canal, that is what you heard. It always takes one bankruptcy before you get anything goes, any business works, as you know. And the people who did fail were the great people in building the canal. And the plan took over well, that you took, but we just pushed ahead and had convinced on all their mistakes and all their disappointments, gentlemen. Take steps to allow yourself to become disappointed. That's more heroic, gentlemen. That's why we celebrate the crucifixion of Jesus, although he was a total failure, because it takes more guts to go to the front and to become Bishop of Rome and have a tiara on your head and be saluted by 120,000 Italian school children with great grief. That's easy. That's the Pope. But Jesus had absolutely no sign of victory during his whole life, just defeat. And that's why I feel that Saint-Simon and Lesseps belong into another history, very definitely, because they planned the two great things, gentlemen, which go together, the Panama Canal and the Suez Canal. And I don't think we believe they are reasonable about the Suez Canal at this moment. The United States have every reason to prevent the Egyptians to take over the Suez Canal, just as we have prevented the Colombians to take over the Panama Canal. And I'm ashamed of our government and of the people even more, who do not see that the England defends there the reason of the world, the reason why this canal was built. That's not a private national enterprise of these Egyptians. It would have never come into being. And what is the reason for something being in existence that has to be supported? The reason is that people 100 years ago, and Saint-Simon was the first, understood that the munition makers and the atom bomb manufacturers, these physicists who blindly serve individual governments, had to be faced by facts that were greater than states and nations. And these would be these worldwide canals, because they would force the nations to consider the earth as one. And who tells you that the people in Panama own the Panama Canal? Who tells you that the people in Egypt own the Suez Canal? Isn't that ridiculous? Or that the Spaniards own Gibraltar? As long as the English kept all the seven seas open, they had the right to administer them. If you now try to replace the English, please replace them. But don't tell Mr. Naguib that he can go and prevent every Israeli ship to go through the Suez Canal because that's a private Egyptian enterprise. Is that unheard of? And that's what we allowed it to happen every day. It's a lake now. A pond. This comes, you see, when things are not understood. The canal system, these two mighty canals, is a victory over the 19th century nationalism, which this man, at the beginning of this century, already foresaw as the only means of talking Turkey. You see, Saint-Simon had this great insight then to say, see, that the nations of this world must be faced by facts that are bigger than their own ideology and their own speech. And these canals, you see, he thought, would simply outrun national boundaries. This is an ingenious idea of recreating the universe, you see, in a new fashion, isn't it? Now, I said this before, because these two things, I think you have some perspective. Saint-Simon, at the age of 60, tried to commit suicide. He had nothing to eat. He lived on water only. Finally, he found an old servant who had served him in his days of great wealth of wealth and richness, and who supported him. And in the last 5 years, he went blind in the attempt to take his own life. He he found some real pupils. That is, the success of Saint-Simon came in the last 5 years of his life. All the first 60 years he battled against his scientists. For example, he would have dinner every week at great expense, he had still his money left, to feast all these mathematicians and all these chemists, to learn from them, to find out about them, to understand what they really were doing. And then, at the end, he summarized it all in this great, you see, proclamation. Step down! Step down! But you may say, gentlemen, that every beginner of a new cycle wastes his time with getting out of the old. And you may say that Saint-Simon had only 5 years of great clarity of knowing what he should not do. Before, he had always coquetted really trying to be on good terms with the powers that be. And try to talk them into this, into reason. You can think of Anton of Canterbury and of Abelard, who also tried to make the new, you see, thinking work within the local school of Paris or the Archbishopric of Canterbury, and it didn't succeed. Anton of Canterbury was exiled from England to Rome because the King of England, of course, wanted to have an independent, didn't want to have an independent archbishop. And Abelard, you know, was castrated by enemies and exiled from Paris. And now in the same way, Saint-Simon is a failure in his own life. And I want you to vaccinate you gentlemen with this experience that failure is greatness in such a situation. When it isn't done for any selfish reason, but in the service of something nobody understands because it is said for the first time. What is his Christmas? His Christmas is that the work mankind has to do all over the globe. And the learned men have to show each other all over the earth and at all times. Deserve both a thorough new organization. The first thing his disciples showed was a code de la pudeur. Law book on shame. Those of you who know my business on shame know that I protested this more against the treatment of pudeur, of shame, as something obnoxious, or something of a guilt complex, as it is treated today. Gentlemen, the future belongs to those who can be ashamed. And I'm afraid the American prognostication is very poor because of the shamelessness. The only hope I have is that Americans are very deeply ashamed about their patriotism. And I therefore think that American people are very good Americans because they don't never talk about it. The people like the French who always talk about their patriotism, as you know, they go home with them. And that's why they have a great future. Thousands of years ago, the Russian nation is still flourishing because they have this great secrecy about love. And your only hope is that you have the same great secrecy about American patriotism. Everybody in this country knows that when people talk loud about patriotism, they are no patriots.
Would you say it would be okay?
So, gentlemen, look where a nation, where a group of people have their greatest embarrassment, their greatest reticence, their greatest silence, and you know where their greatest strength is. Their main strength is where his secret is, where he won't have his heart on his sleeve. How do you say it? Now, Saint-Simon uses, and he had these two maxims, society must protect shame. Shamelessness is destructive. And society must protect honest work. Unemployment is immoral. Or this he all said in 1817, 8 years before his death, when he published his first idea of an industrial society. Unemployment is immoral. Now, gentlemen, it has taken 130 years before you can say such a thing in this country without being ridiculed. And as you know, Mr. Meany made a statement yesterday in which he said the rich people want unemployment again because that means that they have an easier labor policy. And this is a battle today. Is unemployment immoral, or is it not? Every one of you must know that obviously the thing isn't so simple. It's the life is unjust laws in the Middle Ages, you see. Unjust laws may be disobeyed, just laws must be obeyed. I would say with unemployment, gentlemen, we are faced today with a great question. Self-unemployment is desirable, is inevitable for a capitalist system. You have no unemployment whatsoever. You are the slave of accident. You cannot change your reinvest your labor force. I mean, it's impossible. This is nonsense. No unemployed is against life. Just as you have to have some white blood corpuscles in reserve when you have a wound. You have to be able to delegate this pus into this wound to heal. There must be a surplus of your body. You have to have some loose ends. You see, you have to get loose ends to a certain extent. But if you get leukemia, that would be, you see, indefinitely unemployment in your body. Leukemia means that these same white blood corpuscles, which are very good to heal an open wound, you see, are deadly when they multiply. And I would say that unemployment is not simply bad or good. That's not true. The unions are quite wrong when they say no unemployment, and the Chamber of Commerce quite wrong when they say, oh, I welcome unemployment because that means I can lower the wages. It's a much more subtle problem. How much unemployment? That's your problem. There is a quality and quantity. I'm very proud, gentlemen. I became a member of the modern era and seems to be a romantic bourgeois of the 19th century. Because I've been 3 times really unemployed, being married and having a family, and I put myself into the hands of the labor unions who made me unemployed because I tried to teach them and I wasn't a Marxian, so they didn't like the idea very much. Gentlemen, to be unemployed, I think, is the baptism of the modern society. And then the secret of love is the other credential of your initiation into this modern society. Nobody who still believes that everything should be said and known has made the grave beyond the 18th century. Gentlemen, Saint-Simon stands beyond the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment says light is better than night. Saint-Simon says there must be light and there must be night in alternation. That is shame. Shame says that at times you must be silent about your patriotism or your love. And at times you must know. The girl which you get up for green tea is not the girl you're going to marry. Just keep it a secret. The dates which you date are not the final choice. And the more screens you can put up with the girls which the other boys see, the safer you are in the real choice of your sweetheart. It's a great protection, the other girl. Who other girl? Now, gentlemen, the Enlightenment then is the academic side. In the Enlightenment, knowledge is better than ignorance. In society, we are quite indifferent to knowledge or ignorance. We want to know at the right moment. We want to know when we have to know. And we want others not to know when they shouldn't know. That is, in Saint-Simon's cycle, there is a silken, not an iron, but a silken curtain, which can be drawn and withdrawn according to the familiarity with which you live with certain people. Society has degrees of intimacy. Nature has not. Nature is better when known. Society is not better when it is known. When the government knows your income tax, it isn't any better, just different. Knowledge, gentlemen, of other people, of your own life, is very dangerous. At a certain moment, you want to tell them. At another moment, you say, go to hell, I won't tell you. Just as you see Mr. Eisenhower had to say it at this moment. because he can't go on with a body of faithful officials if he doesn't protect them. So suddenly society comes down with a bang and says, no, knowledge is not better than ignorance. There's a secret. And I would be ashamed, the president said, if I would not jeopardize the confidence of all my collaborators. I can't do that. The same is true, will be true in the State Department. Very soon nobody wants to serve in the State Department because these people are just exposed to all kinds of insults. You have to have intimacy in a secret service. You have to have a feeling of staff work, of teamwork. And who gives away the secrets of his team? That's personal. So, gentlemen, draw the line. Cyril Simon and the modern sociologists compare as Cyril Simon being modern and the modern sociologist being quite obsolete. The modern sociologist in Chicago still thinks that knowledge of the social facts at all costs is better than secrecy. If you are responsible for the running of any family, or any club, any city, any nation, you know very well that the dirty linen has to be washed at home. And you know very well that it is not desirable that anything is said at the wrong moment. There may be a time when it has to be said, but the timing is in itself an essential part of the social science, of the social knowledge. Gentlemen, peace cannot be had without a relation to the time sense. Therefore, enlightenment has only validity for nature. You all are steeped in the idea of the enlightenment. Therefore, you do not belong into the 20th century. As long as you do not make room for secrecy, you do not. Now, every one of you does, but you don't do it in the realm of your scientific thinking, but if you are good politicians, you do. It is said of Mr. Stevens that he is Secretary of War today, of Defense, because he kept his mouth shut in Yale for the first 3 years until he made the senior society, because nobody knew on what, how he stood on any one issue. Now, at least it takes nerve to be so silent. I don't recommend it, but I only want to tell you that you all are, like Mr. Stevens, very well acquainted with the rules of a game which is not academic, not scientific, not objective, and not sociological, and not psychological. When you are out for your own advancement, you know very well that you have to keep a secret. Now, gentlemen, who would a sociologist be who would not finally learn his lesson and say, therefore, society is a living unit in which there must be secrets. Without secrets, no peace. That's the logic of Saint-Simon. So we have these two tenets, gentlemen, of the Saint-Simonism. Peace, shame, solidarity. You must feel solidarity with those whose secrets you do not divulge. Or unemployment, or unemployment as a shame. It must be considered. This is all new, gentlemen. For the last 10 or 30 years, Saint-Simon was so far ahead of his time that if you today go to New York City and publish these three things, peace, secrecy, solidarity, they either say you are communist or you say you are a Roman Catholic. You do not see, they do not see that you are the most modern man in the world. Gentlemen, when I went to school, there was in no textbook of economics a chapter on unemployment. It didn't exist. It was a cause of such shame that the capitalistic textbooks just didn't mention it. Unemployment was not mentioned. You can look them up. Any book printed before 1930 in America or Germany has no special chapter on unemployment. Just something. We are sorry. It's a crisis. nothing specific, no problem how to deal with it. As you know, Mr. Keynes was the first who acknowledged this. Logically. Saint-Simon knew it in 1817. Then look at shame. Psychoanalysis says, see it all, spit it out, no shame. Murder your father, sleep with your mother. Again, that's the latest news in this country. Gentlemen, how absurd. If you treat marriage as nature, you can never get married. If you treat your parents as nature, you can never respect them. If you treat your children as nature, you can never educate them. Very simple, these three rules, gentlemen. You can't love anybody who is nature, you can't respect anybody who is nature, and you can't educate anybody who is nature. You can train an animal, but you can't educate an animal. You can't love a piece of nature. You can rape it, and you cannot respect a piece of nature. You can manipulate your parents, as you try to do. Gentlemen, respect, education, and love are in society, and they are not found in nature. They are not found in nature. Why, gentlemen? These three actions, and again, Saint-Simon knew this, or I should say defined it. These three actions come under a sanction which doesn't exist in nature. Because to educate gentlemen and to love and to respect, what is needed? Can you describe this to me? What is the difference from an animal? Why can't an animal respect, educate, and love? Very important for you to know. Of course, by now you should know it if you look at the Ten Commandments of Education. I've talked about this all the time, but I come back now, this is quite a kind of surprise on you. You've forgotten it all. Love, respect, and education. Point before your death, beyond your death and before your birth. They make lives that have gone on before you and lives that comes after you of the same intensity and importance as your own. For a man who is educated, that which he is educated in is of the same vitality as his own little nature. Jefferson, or the Gettysburg Address, or the Sermon on the Mount, is right here today. There's no reason to say it's 1900 years old if you are educated. Or you are educated. Respect the same. These people are old whom you are meant to respect. But for an educated person, gentlemen, remember what he said? There's no difference between old and young. Nothing is good because it is young. Nothing is good because it is old. You respect something despite the fact that it is old. Because it is still in Germany. If you now admit you respect something more, it is because it doesn't matter that he died in 1824. Isn't that true? That's the only reason why you can respect somebody. Because it doesn't matter that he is old. I cannot ask you to respect me because I'm old, but I can ask you to respect me although I'm old. If you can look through my wrinkles and my white hair, then you have made a step into the real world. So what is this world of yours which you come up with your 70 years of fleshly existence? That's very, very little. In this you couldn't learn to speak, in this you couldn't learn to think, in this you couldn't be educated, in this you couldn't respect, and you couldn't educate your children because your children will live in another world. Again, and it will look quite different from yours. And can't you educate them just the same? Can't you fill them with a healthy contempt for the world? Can't you tell them that the world looks different every year? That now you have television psychoanalysis, and they will have microvision, and I don't know, psychosynthesis, and it will be equally stupid and equally rotten. And you have to tell this to your poor children. Because otherwise it will go exactly as bankrupt as you go by buying a television set without needing it. But you're so helpless. You all think that the news is the best. You have absolutely no yardstick to penetrate beyond your own existence. And gentlemen, so you have nothing to say. Gentlemen, in nature, we said, nature is reality minus speech. Nature is reality minus speech. Now, gentlemen, society is reality ruled by the word. Respect and education and any declaration of love are forms of speech. People you respect, who are they? The people you listen to. People whom you educate are the people you want to listen to you. Isn't that true? And people you love, gentlemen, you can converse with. You write lyrical poems to me. Or letters. Correspondent. You correspond with your sweetheart when she's away. The three groups, gentlemen, to which you have to speak are the women of your own time, the parents of the past, and the children of the future. You have to speak to the unborn children. You have to listen to the people who have lived before you. And that is the essence of a respected education. And you have to converse with the people around you, with your friends, and especially with your with the woman you love. If you have nothing to speak, she'll go and work outside or go in the women's club. And she will make the speeches. As it is in this country, where the husband has nothing to say. And he has nothing to say. He's just fretting. That's why they sleep with every South American tenor or Yugoslavian athlete, because they're so bored sticks, these poor women. Because their husband has nothing to tell them. No miracles, no respect, no education, no gods, no shame, no secret. They're bored sticks, these poor women in this country. Because they wait for a non-natural world, for a social world, gentlemen, in which all reality is mediated to them by the world, by that which is said. They are hungry for poetry. They are hungry for epics. They are hungry for drama. Because I tell you, gentlemen, education is drama. Because a young person is introduced into life and doesn't know how the curtain rises. You know, when you bring up a child, how dramatic everything looks to the child. You have been seen it before, but the child sees everything for the first time. In conversation with your sweetheart, it's all lyrics. It's all poetry. Rhyme, duet. You can sing a duet as in Figaro. And epics, that's what the old people tell you, what has been before. That's history. So you get the three forms of speech, gentlemen, in every family. In every human existence, epics, lyrics, drama. And you can't be without it. And then you get the fourth form, who has been in philosophy 9? Well, you remember? When you want to get rid of your society, you analyze it in a novel. In a prose novel, you see, in a naturalistic story. The short story is written to get rid, to get out of something, to lose your respect. To have nothing to do with it, just to look at it with detachment. In this country, as you know, you think that to write means to write prose and to analyze. Gentlemen, real writing is epical story, like War and Peace by Tolstoy. That's epics. Or John Brown's Body by Vincent Stephen Burnett. That's epical, is poetic. And lyrics, I need not tell you, I hope you are still some. And drama, that's completely lacking in the way. It all ends in disaster. I mean, Mr. O'Neill doesn't introduce the youth of the country into the dramatic events of the future, but mourning becomes Electra. We have to sit through. And who has read that? That's really the end of an era. Can't you understand? I mean, everything goes to pot. That we call drama. That is, the future is just destruction. Enlightenment, psychoanalysis, obsession. There is nobody to be educated. Everybody is a slave of the passions of the past. Nobody is to be emancipated. And it's very typical of this country, gentlemen, of Western men. If Mr. O'Neill is a dramatist of this era, then why don't you take a ticket and fly as fast as you can to some other star? Because this world is at an end. If mourning becomes Electra is the expression of our time, gentlemen, I certainly have, for the last 40 years, nothing to do with it. I've always tried to write off the decline of the West. This happened when I was born, so to speak, the decline of the West. But you still eat it all up. You read Proust. And you read O'Neill, and I don't know what, and James Joyce, and all these assassinations of the corpse of Western men. Because there's no ethics, there's no drama, and there's no lyrics and all this. It's just all analysis. I pity you, gentlemen. Get out of this. You are obsessed. obsolete. You are academic people, analytical people, psychological people. You're treating men as things. Things start. Morning becomes Electra, Sunday. So let's get away from Electra. So gentlemen, this is all Saint-Simon. The man who started with Saint-Simon the new Christ cycle is a German. His name is Goethe. G-O-E-T-H-E. Goethe was not a poet. If you want to understand Goethe, please drop this terrible expression that he was a poet. Because in English, the word poet narrows him down to the author of some epics, of some lyrics. Then they say, über allen Wipfeln ist Ruhe, or something like that. Gentleman Emerson called him a writer, by which he wanted to say that there was nothing that Goethe did not try to articulate. And here we come a little nearer to the truth. Why is Goethe the father of a new cycle of the social sciences? For the simple reason that he said, everything I write is a fragment of one great confession. Now he has written scientific books, he has written letters, he has written dramas, he has written lyrics, he has written novels, he has written Faust, which is a mixture of, like Dante's Divine Comedy, a mixture of drama and epics. There is no form of language, of style, which Goethe has not used in his perhaps 120 volumes of his collected works. What does this mean, gentlemen? He said it himself. Everything I say are fragments of one full confession. And the second, when other people lose language, I have been endowed with the gift of being able to say what I suffer. He should have perhaps said, I'm able to say what you suffer. That would make it clear to you that Goethe is the first social scientist conscious of the fact that the social science, gentlemen, has to give back to the natural men the power to speak. Can you take this down? The problem of the social science is to give back to a naturalized individual the power to speak. Goethe lived from 1749 to 1832. His name is Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. He was made an aristocrat. And he is, like Saint-Simon, the contemporary of Napoleon. But he is like Anton of Canterbury, and Saint-Simon is like Abelard. Or he is like, Saint-Simon is like Paracelsus, and Goethe is like Copernicus. Copernicus, will you take this down again, gentlemen? Anselm Copernicus did. I've said this before, when we started on these cycles. Are peaceful aristocrats, to use the term you don't like, who are received by their contemporaries as dignified people, who are one of the society of their time. And they are not at odds. Abelard, Paracelsus, and Saint-Simon are terribly at odds with their own time. They sacrifice their regular existence to the sowing of the new. And it keeps really, it should take your breath, gentlemen, how many forms are needed in the kingdom of heaven to give birth to new life. Goethe and Saint-Simon are totally different. Anselm and Abelard are totally different. One, Goethe is at peace with the Emperor of Russia, the Emperor of Austria. He's ennobled by the Emperor of Austria. Napoleon pays him the compliment as being the greatest man of his time. And the Werther, the book on suicide, was on every battlefield with Napoleon. He has read it 7 times, I think. I forgot the number of times. But he told Goethe that he had read it many a times, only to show you how the man who is the greatest figure of the 19th century was struck down by the Werther. Now, I already gave you away the secret. We talked about suicide without this connection with Goethe. But Goethe was able to illuminate, gentlemen, the borderline is of menace nature and menace speaking. The suicide is only possible if self is thing. Werther is written on this discovery that by writing it, he saved his own life. The word gentleman comes over Goethe in this passionate book, which fed many generations of readers, by the way, because gentlemen, now the great secret comes in. We speak to get beyond our own nature. We speak to save our lives. Speech has been implanted into men as our weapon against death. When you hear that your best friend wants to commit suicide, what do? You speak to him. And it usually is enough to take him back into reality, and a man who is spoken to usually is out of danger. If he is crazy and you can't speak to him, you can't, his word, your word doesn't mention, then he will still jump out of the window. But that means that you have not been able to speak to him. But then you can reach a person by speaking to him. He enlarges the reality to which he belongs. Gentlemen, by speaking, we get every moment beyond the here and now. I, by speaking to you at this moment, gentlemen, get you into 2050 and 1800 without any difficulty, because they are speaking of Goethe. And you believe that you can understand what Goethe meant. Isn't that miraculous? Here you sit in 1954 at this very moment in this classroom, simply by my talking, you suddenly find yourself face to face with your grandchildren and with your great-grandfather. The word, gentlemen, is has come into the world against local and temporal death. If you depended on your little bit of an existence at this moment in this classroom, you very soon would have no oxygen. You would have no direction. You wouldn't know what to do tomorrow. If really everything should come out of this classroom here, if you think this true, gentlemen, you cannot live at all by that which is here. And you cannot live by that which you find in your dormitory. And you cannot live by that which you find in Baker Library. You can only live if the word by which you telephone, literally, into all times of past and future, if the word can make a connection. The word, gentlemen, has the power to take everybody out of his here and now. That's why we speak. Goethe knew this. And Goethe, therefore, is not the advocate of the new two topics, work and love, shame and solidarity. But he is the herald of the power to speak. The power to speak, gentlemen, is drained out of you at this moment. What is the power to speak, gentlemen? This will be the topic next time. But I hope I have made so much clear that although Goethe lived from 1749 to 1832, and Sandy Moore lived from 1760 to 1825, they are much younger than you. They both have started something that has to be done against your resistance. You are the stumbling block in this way, because you don't believe them.